Hi everyone, welcome to Hoffman's podcasting class at the Merritt School. What you're about to hear is a series of the students' new shows. There'll be a handful of them, and then in a few days, we will release the second half. This is no comment on how good they are, it's just too long of a darn show otherwise. So, the first show we're going to start with is Mr. B and McKee. It's a conversational style movie review podcast hosted by Mr. B and McKee, the cynic and the optimist respectively, focusing on the ranking, reviewing, and breaking down of blockbusters, big box office movies, directors, actors, big movie series, etc. They rank movies, they rank characters, and offer how to fix bad movies and think of other ways to analyze them. So enjoy!
What's up, guys? I'm Tommy Bizzuto.
I'm Jackson McKee.
And we're here to tell you about our awesome movie review podcast, Mr. B and McKee Movie Talk.
I enjoy this one. This one is fun to me.
In our podcast, we're going to dive deep into your favorite blockbuster franchises.
We're going to be reviewing and ranking the movies you love.
They're just ridiculous enough to work.
I'm going to try to get you to see the best in these movies.
Oh, cool. This is happening.
And I'm going to have to be the one to bring you back down to earth, because even your most beloved films can be absolute trash.
That's not how the Force works.
We'll break down movies based on all of their aspects.
The only thing more intense than our brutal honesty is our love for movies.
So go ahead and check it out.
Hi, welcome back to another episode of Mr. B and McKee. I'm Mr. B.
I'm McKee.
And today we're going to be answering an age-old question. Which movie is better, Home Alone 1 or Home Alone 2? We've taken bold stances on each movie, and today we're going to flesh out and see which one is better.
Yeah. I thought both movies were good, but I thought one was better than the other, but that's my opinion. The movies were both really good. I liked them. It wasn't a movie where they weren't movies where I was sitting there and was like, please just end this now. It was, oh, cool, this is happening. Or, oh, look, something else has happened.
Yeah, and I think that's like really interesting with like movies that are led by a child actor, the main character is a child actor, and that can go like a bunch of different ways. But like everybody is captivating, there's not a shortage of witty comedy, it's fresh all the time, and it never really is it never loses you. It always keeps you. It's very paced very well. And so let's get into it, because I think that Home Alone 2 is better, and you think that Home Alone 1 is better, and you definitely have to, like, have a favorite. So, let's go into Home Alone 1, all right? What was your feel about this movie?
I feel like this one is a bit of a holiday classic, especially for me. I watched it a lot, like, as I was growing up. Still am growing up, but I've still watched it a lot. And, like, I enjoy this one. This one is fun to me.
Yeah, that's, like, the best thing that a Christmas movie can be. Just good fun. What I think is great about this one is that you're basically getting to live out a child's fantasy. And, like, there's no shortage of, like, possibility with that. And then there's the humor is so witty and fun. And the characters are just great. And like, all the characters are memorable. There's not, like, a side character that is just like, oh yeah, he's there. Everybody is very distinct. On the flip side, though, there is a lot to this movie that you kind of just have to accept. Like, there's a lot of scenes where things just play out in a way that, okay, that would never happen in real life, but it's fine. It's a movie. I get that. And it's just a lot of conveniences, and that was, like, my general feel of this movie. So let's move into the positive aspects. What did you think?
I thought that Macaulay Culkin did a really good job. Like, Kevin is clearly meant to be, like, this little spastic smart aleck of a, 10-year-old?
Yeah, I think he was
10. He's 10?
Yeah.
And he just does such a good job with it. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it was the beginning. he's talking to his dad, and he says, I made something out of fish hooks. And the dad goes, my new fish hooks? Can't make them with the old ones. They got fish guts all over them. It's like comments like that.
Yeah, like sometimes it's just a testament to how like clever they've written him as, and like how well Macaulay can portray that. I totally agree. Yeah. What else?
I also thought that Joe Pesci did a decent job, like a good job. You could tell something was off from the start when like he smiles at I think it's Kevin. He smiles at him, and you're like, something is not right here.
Mm-hmm. Like, as you looks, see Joe Pesci play a cop. You just don't
know what can happen. And he looks like he's in pain when he's smiling at him, too.
All right. And what else?
I also thought that the siblings all did a good job. Like, the various family members did a good job. It seems they all hate Kevin to some extent, but they're super helpful when they need to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And it's hilarious how, like, relatable it can be. Like, I have two brothers, and the dynamic is a lot like that, where the big ones are beating down the little ones, and the little one's a brat. I admit, I can be a brat. But, and it's very believable. There's not a caricature in these siblings, so you can believe that they're a family. And I like that, too. So what else?
Old Man Marley, you always... That's always such a fun thing for me. Because, like, at the beginning, you're like, he probably did kill somebody.
Yeah, he definitely could. He definitely can pull off that kind of look.
And then you get to, like, right before the final 20 minutes or so, and you start to feel bad for him. Mm-hmm. You're like, he's like, my son is estranged. I haven't talked to him. I can't see my granddaughter. So you didn't kill your family.
Yeah. So, was that all the positive aspects you had?
I had a lot of, like, things I liked, but it's more specific things that we could talk about later.
But please get into it as much as you want. I'd love to talk about that.
I liked the running joke at the beginning about everybody taking out that statue and that they have out front. Like, everybody's pulling up to their house, and they just keep hitting that one statue that's right by the door.
Yeah, it's such a funny, like, little running gag that they have. And, like, it even picks up in the second one, if you notice.
Yeah, I saw that.
Like, in the beginning of the second one, and the first car misses it, but then the second car hits it.
Just boom.
And now it's like, okay, they're not going to do that gag, but then they do it again. But that's just getting into the second one. So, continue.
The sequence of them running around, getting out of town was really cool. It was, like, kind of funny to me.
Yeah. And I, like, especially sped up, like, the camera a little
bit. Yeah.
That was funny.
And there's the scene in the airport where she realizes that, like, kind of in the airport where they, like, kick the lady off the phone. She's like, get out.
That was funny.
Get out of here.
Yeah. And it's like, it's interesting because, like, a mother will do anything. For, like,
yeah,
kick off a French lady off the phone. That was funny.
I thought the chase scene with the cop when he takes the toothbrush was kind of funny. How he just kind of, like, slid under everybody and the cop was trying to, like, run after him. Mm-hmm. And then that John Candy cameo was awesome.
Yeah,
I liked that.
John Candy's hilarious. He's a treasure. He's a treasure.
Yeah. And then I really liked that entire, like, the last, I think, 20 minutes or so where he's defending the house mm-hmm. against Harry and Marv.
Yeah, it's like a great third act.
It's yeah.
Like, it's iconic. It's totally iconic.
Yeah. What about you? Did you have anything that you liked?
What's that?
Did you have anything that you liked?
Oh, I have, like, yeah. So, my thing with this movie was the casting is so great. Catherine O'Hara does a great job. She's super believable as a mom. She's managing a lot. And then she gets really stressed out. And then, like, what she realizes, Kevin's gone. She's like, oh, my gosh, I have to get back to my son. And that was really great. It played out very nicely. Joe Pesci, I think this is his worst nightmare because he's stuck in a PG movie. And Joe Pesci is, like, very well known for his, like, yeah. kind of very, like, harsh language, shall we say.
Yeah, there was, like, a fun fact I saw that him and Daniel Stern had a very hard time not cursing.
Yes, and, like, so when he goes, like, that is just, like, it's just fun to see him in like a kid's movie. You never see that. And that was just great. I loved, he was a great addition. And then with Kevin, he is like, this was like the perfect person to cast. Macaulay Culkin. He was the, I'm not a big fan of child actors. I know they're necessary and all that, but like, there are a few that I think that can pull off a role well enough that I like the character. Macaulay Culkin does a great job. They have written him as this very witty kid. He's very sassy. He, very clever. He knows, like, more than, not necessarily like he's a genius, but like, he's clever. He's got tricks and stuff like that. He knows what's going on. And yeah. And I just thought that was great. And then I also thought the John Candy cameo was great. I thought it was funny how he plays two similar characters within this one. And then Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, if you've seen that one, you know he's he plays like the kind of overbearingly nice guy, but he like can like rub off the wrong way sometimes. And I just thought that was great. And from a writing standpoint, I've already talked about how Kevin was great. But he actually gets a character arc. He goes from the selfish brat who all his siblings hate. His mom is like having a hard time with him. And then as the film goes on, he kind of learns a little bit like, okay, I've been a brat. I think I need to change this. And he becomes this kind of like self-sufficient person, some very kind person. He knows like he's learned how to like do laundry. Like in the
and go shopping at the grocery store.
In the beginning, he's like, "Oh, you're completely helpless." But then he, over the course of the film, he learns all this stuff. So he's kind of like learning. And from about the Wet Bandits, they're just a hilarious duo. You've got Marv, who's the dummy, and Harry, who's the irritated straight man. And they're just, they like balance each other very well. And with Old Man Marley, he's an awesome little subversion of expectations. You think he's this like old grunt. Like old grumpy man who's like a suspected killer, and then when you move into the like the beginning of the third act, the end of the second act, to the beginning of the third act, he's this really nice guy who's just misunderstood. He has, and it's actually a very good message. Like, okay, you can't judge people about what you hear. You have to like sort it out for yourself. You have to see this person, how this person is like in real life, not just what you've heard. And I thought that was really nice. And I thought everything tied together very nicely. And Old Man Marley uses his snow shovel against the bad guys, which I thought was very symbolic of like perceived evil, which is Old Man Marley defeating actual evil with the Wet Bandits. And I liked that. And then Kevin gets his family back on Christmas, and Old Man Marley, is it Marley or Murphy? I'm getting my notes mixed up. We'll edit this out. But yeah, Old Man Marley reunites with his son, and that, and I just thought it all tied together very nicely. And the events that lead to Kevin being home alone, they're ridiculous, but they're just ridiculous enough to work. And I thought that was a fun ride.
It wasn't like they were stretching it. Like, it's like,
yes.
There's no way that happens. Mm-hmm. It's like, this could actually happen. We're rushing out the house. Like,
it's holding on by a thin thread, but it could definitely happen. And then the music, just really quickly, the music is great. John Williams is like, this is not a role you think John Williams would take on with a kid's movie, but it is just great. And it's become one of his classics.
Yeah.
So let's move into the negative things. What did you think about this movie, negative light?
What did I think? I thought that I didn't like how unrealistic it got at times with defending the house. Like, I liked it was a great, I thought it was a great sequence. But, like, somebody would look at that. Like, a robber would look at that and go, maybe we should be more on our toes. Maybe there's more traps here.
Yeah, and, like, they, like, I love this one thing, that Marv goes into the house wearing gloves without fingers on them. So he's, like, he's got bare fingers that will leave fingerprints, and you're like, okay, come on. You wouldn't do that. But, yeah, I get that totally.
And, like, also, I want to... I don't know how to word this. The scene with the kid at the beginning, their neighbor, mm-hmm. I think he's their neighbor, and they're like, we're going to go to Florida. Mm-hmm. Who was that? Like, was it Kevin's cousin or something? Like, patted this kid on the head when...
No.
11.
If I may, this is when his neighbor shows up, and that's meant to... So when they do the head count, he's there, back turned. They don't realize it's not Kevin. They pat him on the head. They miscount. They leave Kevin behind. It's just a little tool to, like, help the plot go on.
Yeah, that's true. And, like, also, I think that his uncle, the one Uncle Frank, was, like, really mean to him. Mm-hmm. He was like, look what you did, you little... And I don't remember what he calls him, but he's like... You little jerk.
Yeah.
And then he just does nothing to help at the end, like, while they're trying to find him. He's just like, I'm going to sit here and watch TV.
Yeah.
My nephew's at home alone. I'm going to watch TV.
If I might say, I don't think that's very much a negative aspect. It's definitely something you can dislike. He's not meant to be, like, a character that is redeeming. He's not meant to get a big character arc. He's a side character. But I like Uncle Frank. I think he's, like, just kind of selfish. You're absolutely right. He's a selfish, like, mean uncle. But you can't really fault the movie for that. That's what it's going for.
But, like, those were the only things I found negative. Like, I wasn't...
Yeah, I wasn't getting that at all. That's great. Yeah. So what I thought the biggest problem with this movie... is that there's just too many things that make you go, huh. Like, I totally agree. Like, they were stretching a couple little things. Not so much leading to where Kevin is left alone, but, like, throughout the course of the whole movie. Like, when they go to the shop and he takes a toothbrush, it's a lone child taking a toothbrush, and you're making such a big deal out of it. I understand if it was, like, I don't know, jewelry or something like that, but he's a little kid. He's taking a toothbrush. I mean, come on, don't call the cops on him. Sort it out for yourself. And then I also thought it was weird how the Santa, like the store Santa, like he hears this kid wish for his family back. He physically, like, the Santa physically, like, is shown to think that it's strange that this kid is asking for his family back, but he just gets in his car and doesn't do anything about it. I'm like, okay, that's a little weird. And then why wouldn't Kevin just call the police in the first place when he knew that the wet bandits were coming? That part didn't make sense to me. And leading into that, I felt that his whole battle plan with setting the traps and everything, it isn't very established well. We've seen that he's clever, but the idea that he could set all these super elaborate traps and, like, kind of, like, hurt these people, like, really badly, it definitely comes out of nowhere. If we had seen... Because we've seen Kevin, like, set up, like, we saw him set up the little show with all his, like, the man.
With the firecrackers, too.
Well, yeah, but nobody was getting hurt then. And it wasn't totally elaborate. And we've seen him do, like, these, like, clever little tricks here and there. But nothing so, like, Like, there's this theory that, Kevin, like, grew up to become Saul. And you definitely get that from the ending. But yeah. From the beginning, you don't get that. And I thought, like, as weird as it sounds, like, I wish they would have, like, have Kevin set more traps in, like, the beginning. Because then the ending would have been a little bit more believable for me. And then with the mom, Catherine O'Hara, I think, does a great job. She's written very well. But the whole – she and Kevin, their relationship and their whole relationship with the family is the emotional centerpiece of this story. And the whole importance and power of Kevin's mom's struggle to get home in time to, like – not necessarily to get home in time, but, like, just to get home to Kevin. It's totally undercut because the family gets there the same time as her.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. And then the family gets home at the same time she does.
Yeah, and it's like, if they had just waited even a little bit longer, just like even an hour more to have the family come in, I think that would have been more powerful. Because suppose that she didn't go through all this stuff to get to Kevin on that day, and they took the flight that the family took instead. And she would have gotten there the exact same time. So all this stuff she's been doing, it means nothing. And so basically everything she's done for the entire movie has been pointless. And I thought that was like that was a big drawback for me. But overall, this movie is just great. There's nothing that's so bad about this movie that you can't like enjoy it. It's very pleasant. There's only just a few little nitpicks here and there for me.
Yeah.
And so Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, generally I think that this is just an amazing movie because everything you love about Home Alone 1 is dialed up to like 11. This movie comes up with like new and different ways to make you laugh. The setting is great. And in many ways, it's a story about what excess looks to a little child. But on the flip side, this movie is by nature bigger than the first one. And as a consequence of that, the flaws the first one had are amplified here. What did you think generally about this movie?
I didn't mind it. I felt that it was essentially a repetition of the first one. Like, he gets separated from his family. Mm-hmm. Harry and Marv show up. That's a problem. They somehow tell him what they're going to do. He stops them, and then he finds his family by the end of the movie. Mm. And thrown in there is some creepy older person.
Yeah. I definitely agree with you on that. And repetition is almost like full on repetition is never good in a movie. You want something fresh and something new. And I think that this movie actually did enough where it didn't seem like just a rehash of the original. So I did enjoy that. So let's move into the positive aspects. So first of all, I think that this one came in and didn't lose any of the wit. It's funny. The humor is, it's not baseline humor. It's not fart gags and stuff like that. It's clever in the way it makes you laugh. And I very much appreciate that. It's similar to the first one in that regard. And it definitely stays true to the original, which it's not like a totally different movie, but it's not a total rehash of the original, as I said earlier.
Can I add something to the joke, to like the witty part of it? There was a joke in there, and Kevin, they're like sitting in the car, and she's like, "Where's Kevin?" And he just plops in the front seat and is like,
"That was awesome.
It's a good thing I have a ticket in case you guys tried to ditch me."
Exactly. And like the stuff like that is just like, it like gets your heart racing for a second, and then he comes in and relieves the tension. And humor like that is great. I love that. And somehow the events leading to Kevin and his family being separated are somehow more believable in this one, just a little bit. But it was fascinating how I just thought that like the first one was stretching it a little bit. This one, when he just gets separated by the flight, I thought was more believable. And when they go to New York, that is just a great setting. It's bigger than the original, definitely. But you can sort of keep Kevin in like these different places so he's not roaming New York City the entire time. He goes to the plaza, he goes to his uncle's house, he goes to Central Park. So it's very much contained, but it's also like it's very broad in its setting. So that was great. And then the continued gags were nice. I liked Angels with Even Filthier Souls. That was hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
Tim Curry comes in. That was awesome. And then I thought that the Sticky Bandits, the Wet Bandits, going to the Sticky Bandits. In this one, I thought they had a more believable goal. In the first one, they're targeting just one house. And it's not even like a big mansion. They're assuming what is in the house. They don't know for certain. They can go in the house and there's nothing there. So it was a little bit of a stretch for me to like believe that they would get so caught up with just one house and they're like these quote unquote professional bandits. And in this one, there's this clever little plot about them robbing a toy store. And that was just like an interesting little concept. And it's, to me, makes more sense than just one house.
Yeah.
And this movie is also very visually appealing. It's very colorful, it's very vibrant. There's a lot going on in the background, but it's not too much that you can focus on what's going on. And then Kevin is actually doing something noble by defending the toy store at the end of the movie. And so it's not just he's defending his house, but he's defending like a cause. He's defending the people in the children's hospital. And I thought that was great.
Yeah.
And also with the Sticky Bandits, they're more involved. They're like pushing the plot more, I thought. Because Kevin has, in the original, Kevin really doesn't interact with the Wet Bandits until like
prior to them going into his house. He's just like.
But in this one, they meet up a couple of times, and I just thought like it's better to have your antagonist a little bit more involved with the protagonist, and I thought that was good. And then in this one, I think the best thing that this movie does is correct the big mistake in the first one with Kevin's mom. Like, the part where Kevin reunites with his mom in this one is executed much better, because instead of the mom finding him, then the family shows up right after, she's searching for him. And then she remembers something very distinct about him, that he loves Christmas trees. So she goes there to find him. And when she does, she's the one to bring him back to the family, not the family finds Kevin with her. And I thought that was just great execution. And as far as casting goes, everyone's back. Everyone's still great. And then the new additions are a very good complement to the cast. Like Tim Curry, I thought was a standout. He was just kind of this smoggy, like, snobby character who is like trying to like, who's in Kevin's way. Let's put it like
that.
And I
thought it was so funny when he's getting them out of his room when he's running away from when Kevin.
Yes, and he has to go, I love you.
No, and they're crawling away and everybody's looking at them and he just yells, there is a crazy man with a gun.
Yeah, that was great. I thought that was hilarious. That's like my favorite scene from that movie, I have to say. And so what did you think positively about this movie?
I thought it was good that they kept the statue joke in there at the beginning. As we said earlier, they missed it the first time, just boom, the second time.
Yeah. It's a great way to continue with gags, but in a way that your audience feels, okay, are they going to do this? Okay, it looks like they're not going to do this. Oh, they hit it again.
Yeah, I
totally agree. What else?
I thought that scene with Buzz, where it's like, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I feel so bad that I did this. It was ill-timed.
Yeah.
And then he immediately looks at Kevin and goes, you little snot.
Or no, he goes, you little trout sniffer.
Yeah.
Which is just another like thing about that is just the wit. It's funny. Like, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. I think that's a really good example of how clever this movie is. Absolutely.
And also the scene with the recorder in the bathroom. He recorded his uncle, and then in the hotel room, he plays it again against Tim Curry and is like, get out of here before I slap you, silly. And then also, I liked that the traps got a bit more elaborate. Like, this was so much more elaborate than what he did last time. He was like, oh, I'm going to throw cars on the ground in the first one. The second one, he's like, oh, there's a giant hole. I'm going to get them to go in that giant hole.
Yeah, and to add on to that, I think that's a really good example of how this movie goes bigger than the original and how everything is just dialed up a little bit. And that's definitely with the traps. Because, like, and then there's, like, the scenes where, like, they're pulling on the light bulbs to see if, like, there's something hanging around to fall on them. And they have to, like, they're, like, little ducking out of like caution, and then like they get careless, and the one light bulb that they don't really check lights them on fire. It's a little nice subversion of expectations. I like that.
No, yeah. And also they do that with the paint cans. He's like, "What happened last time? We tried to go up the stairs. we got hit in the head with a paint can. Let's pretend like we didn't, like we got hit with the paint can. Mm-hmm. And then it's just like, oh, hey, they actually did it.
Yeah.
Never mind. Boom. He hits them with, I don't know what you call that.
Yeah, that's like a column that you would put in your stairs to like hold up the rail, I think. I'm not sure. But yeah, that was his. Yeah. And that's another thing, like with the continued gags, they're adding stuff on. That was great. I enjoyed that too.
And like the scene with the tip was funny, where he's like, give me a tip. And Kevin hands him a stick of gum. Mm-hmm. And then when he comes back, he's like, you want a tip? No, I've got enough. And Kevin pulls out this like wad of cash. And then Rob Schneider, he comes back at the like the very end of the movie and he goes, you got a tip for me? And it's Buzz, and Buzz takes the gum out of his mouth and goes, here you go.
Nice family.
Yeah,
I totally agree.
And that's like what I liked about it.
Yeah, that's great. And so for what was not so great with this movie, I definitely think that this movie has less flaws than the original. But just a couple of things. Like, the Pilgrim Lady, she's not as strong of a character as Old Man Marley was. And she still brings a little bit of a little good emotion, but it's just not, it's not, like, it doesn't give you the same like feeling that Old Man Marley gave you, because you're expecting it. That was one thing. And then Kevin's mom has a little bit less to do in the middle, but she does get a good, very good ending, so I appreciated that. But
that scene with the cop where they're in the airport and he's like, has the child ever run away from home?
Yeah.
No.
Has the child ever been behind? Well, there was this one incident. Yeah. Yeah. So what did you think?
I felt like it was a big, as I said earlier, it was a bit of a repetition of the first one. Mm-hmm. There's some parenting issues, I think, in that house. Like, how do you lose the same kid twice? How do you not go like, okay, and especially when they're running, don't put Kevin behind you. Pick him up or have him run in front of you. Don't have him behind you digging through a bag.
Yeah, I feel like the first rule
bound to not pay attention.
Yeah. I feel like the first rule of parenting would be, don't let your child get left behind you. Always keep them in eyesight. But yeah. So I definitely agree with you there.
I didn't like how they hid in a fish truck and nobody saw them. Mm-hmm. Like, they clearly had to get in there at some point and nobody saw them. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? And, like, as you said, the Pigeon Lady is clearly meant to be, like, an Old Man Marley kind of character. Mm-hmm. And I just have one issue with the traps. How in the world did Marv not die? Like, he got hit in the head repeatedly with a brick, and sure, you might be able to live through that. But then, like, 20 minutes later, he immediately holds, like, straight electric nodes for about 20 minutes or for like 10 minutes or so.
I think that's like a very good example of how this movie does not rely on slapstick comedy, but when it uses slapstick comedy, it very much embraces like the Looney Tunes sort of template, where characters can get big devastating hits but they don't take injury. And there's this great video out there with where it shows you like all the injuries they would sustain and where they would die, basically. And it's like you kind of just have to embrace that this is just the slapstick is stretching like the amount to how much these characters can take. So yeah, I totally agree with you there, but I do think that you kind of have to go with it a little bit.
And also, the hotel staff did a terrible job. Mm-hmm. Like, as soon as that child checks in, you'd be like, wait a second. Your dad is doing what? Yeah. And he left you here? Mm-hmm. For who knows how long? And I just got a reservation from you like 5 minutes ago.
Yes, in the real world, reservations take, especially at the Plaza Hotel, they take a little bit longer than like 2 minutes to like register. Yeah. And with the hotel staff, it's definitely a good example of how the Home Alone movies stretch things. And it kind of is a personal thing with people. So either you can believe it or you can't believe it. Obviously, there are instances where they go a little bit overboard with the stretching, but
yeah. I definitely see. Well, those were my problems with the movie. Did you have anything that was, like, you didn't like, I guess?
Well, I've already stated my negative aspects, but
that's true.
So, yeah. Quickly, our little outro, shall we? Our ending arguments. Overall, these are great movies, but Home Alone 1 has a couple things that are just hold it back for me. Home Alone 2, though, even though it has flaws, of course, it's I think what the first one did good, this one did great, and I think it definitely had the benefit of being the sequel. But what's hard about a sequel is making a movie that is both true to the original and something different. And I think that this one did, like, had a very good balance of doing right by the original and also adding a good bit of new content. And so, and in the end, I think that Home Alone 2 Lost in New York is better than Home Alone 1.
I agree with what you said about them both being good movies, and, like, it's very good. I enjoy them both. But I feel like Home Alone 2, the traps, while more elaborate, seem a little unrealistic at times. And it's also very repetitive of the first one. Like, throughout it, as you watch it, you're like, oh yeah, that happened in the first one. But Home Alone, the original Home Alone, you're seeing everything for the first time. You're not like, huh, I saw that before. You're like, oh cool, this kid's about to, like, take care of business with these traps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the original definitely has the benefit of doing something that people have not seen before. And then the sequel kind of, it could definitely be interpreted as a rehash in some areas. I definitely get what you're saying there.
Okay.
All right. That was our take on Home Alone. Thank you for listening, and hope to see you back on Mr. Liam McKee soon.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Frame of Reference. Work life can be interesting. In Frame of Reference, Jessica Bryant and Molly Farrell explore and review a variety of jobs. People will tell their stories about their work life, and the hosts rate their job on a 5-star scale. Wacky, unconventional, and even a bit emotional, this podcast will show off the jobs that people typically do not pay much attention to. Enjoy!
How would you rate your job satisfaction? Frame of Reference is a podcast that explores the tumultuous world of jobs and career paths. At first glance, when you take a look at surface-level jobs and careers, you may think about doctors, lawyers, and the like. But what about unconventional careers?
In Frame of Reference, come and listen to stories about coaching, food service, mechanics, retail, and much more. You name it, and we'll review it on a 5-star scale. Don't be afraid to reach out with your workplace stories and reviews. Show us your passion and inspire a new generation.
Frame of Reference, hosted by Molly Farrell and Jessica Bryant.
Explore and find your passion.
How would you rate your job satisfaction? In today's episode of Frame of Reference, we will be reviewing what it is like to be a soccer coach. I'm your host, Jessica Bryant.
And I'm Molly Farrell.
And it's time to get into the podcast. Today we received a recording from Coach Neil McNabb, the coaching director of the Rush Union Soccer Club. I am lucky enough to have had the pleasure of playing soccer for several years, so I'm familiar with the coaching styles. What about you, Molly?
Well, I haven't played soccer since I was 8, so I can't remember too much from then. So I'm pretty interested to see what he has to say.
I am as well. Let's get into the recording.
Hello, my name is Neil McNabb, and I'm recording this about myself, about my coaching career and playing career for those that may be interested in hearing and learning a little bit about coaching. Most of us got into coaching, I say most of us, the people that I know got into coaching because they couldn't play soccer anymore and still wanted to get back to the game, wanted to be involved and enjoy being out on the field. And I guess there's quite a lot of us that just didn't want to be in an office doing a normal 9-to-5, so it gave us an opportunity to be outside, run around with kids and have fun. Anyways, my playing career took me all over the world, and fortunately enough, I made my U.S. debut out in Colorado many, many moons ago. And actually, the funny story about that is that I made my debut not as myself, and there's very few people that could say that. So moved over to the U.S. and waiting on my international papers to come through. I have a twin brother that also played soccer, and he was injured at the time, and his international papers actually cleared. So I actually made my U.S. debut as a player in Colorado as my twin brother and was announced to the crowd as him, managed to play the game as him, and very proudly picked up a yellow card in his name. He ended up serving a suspension later in the season because he accumulated too many yellow cards. He definitely thanks me for that even to this day, even though it was a very long time ago. So, yeah, lots of experience with working with children, with other coaches. I'm a coach educator now also, to get to share these stories with those folks as well. And believe it or not, the number one trait in any coach that folks and kids look for is actually humor. So I spend most of my time now coming up with one-liners and fun things to say to kids and trying to stay current with their affairs, which keeps me busy and on my toes too. We actually just finished a season with our girls' team. There are a bunch of seniors, and they finished playing, and now moving on to bigger and better things, playing in college or just going to college and hopefully graduating high school, which has been a strange time through 2020. Just being in school is a blessing in itself. And we finished our club career just recently. We now have a video that's coming out, and I'm a little worried about the information that's going to be contained because I was filmed quite a lot on the sideline during the course of the season, and we'll see what the video comes back at because there was a lot of moments out there that we and the parents will see that we weren't really talking about soccer. We were talking about everything but soccer. We made fun of each other. We, played some games on the sideline, it felt like, and talked about some of the opponents and the coaches and sometimes the parents. So it's going to be interesting to see that played back and see what incriminating evidence is presented. And all I can say is maybe it's a good thing that we've come to the end of this playing cycle with these kids, because otherwise I might find myself out of a job. So we'll see where that goes. Thoroughly enjoyed coaching that group. They're a great group of kids, and we certainly wish them well as they progress. And I hope one day that these kids that we're coaching now will come back and give back to the game and enjoy working with other younger children and mentor them and show them the joy of team sports and specifically youth soccer, because it's given me so much over the years. So anyways, my name's Neil McNabb, and I'm going to sign off now. And I hope to see you on the pitch really, really soon. All right, take care.
Wow, I thought that was an interesting audio because he really seemed like he was very enthusiastic with the work of line of work that he does. For me, I think it's a really admirable thing that he's able to coach kids and stick with it for so long, especially with that group of girls he was talking about.
Yeah, I think it's kind of nice that he, you know, was talking about how he didn't really want to work in an office, have a boring job, and that he kind of stuck with something he loved, you know, coaching soccer, playing soccer, and he gets to be around it all the time, and then he gets to, you know, help these younger kids grow up loving the sport, finding something that they love to do, and I just think it's really nice.
I think so as well. What's, like, one of the funniest things you thought about the story? Because I thought when he was talking about how he played as his twin brother, that was interesting.
Oh, yeah. I thought that was really funny.
And then I was also, I'm very curious to see, like, what the documentary is going to be about.
Oh, yeah. I'm excited to see that.
So So what are we going to rate this one out of 5 stars?
Oh, are we about to get rid of this here?
I don't know.
Well, I was going to say, you know, if you're doing something that you love, then yeah, you got to get 5 stars if you're doing something that you love. But, you know, I guess it depends. Say you don't like working with kids, then obviously it's not the job for you.
Exactly. I mean, I would give him like a 5 out of 5 stars for like himself. But for me personally, I don't know if I could deal with coaching like really young kids. So let's compromise and give this a 4 out of 5 stars. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think it's the job for me, but you know.
Thank you guys for tuning into this episode of Frame of Reference. The next episode, we will try and see what else we can come up with for you guys. Thank you.
Finally, in this episode, we have Ghost Stories and Ghouls. The hosts will discuss urban legends and mythologies in a comedy style. I hope you guys have enjoyed this preview, and before long, you should be able to subscribe to All the Kids or stay subscribed to this feed, and you will get all the episodes as they come out of the class. Thank you!
Welcome to Ghost Stories and Ghouls. My co-host Dawson is going to talk to you guys about how things go on this podcast. He'll first go over what our podcast is about and then what we discuss.
Yeah, so hey guys, our podcast is about ghost stories and ghouls from different regions around the world. We dive into the culture of these places and explain how that culture influenced these stories, and in turn, how these stories and legends affect the culture now. We dive into all the lore of these tales and bring on guests with little prior knowledge to get their thoughts and reactions to these stories.
Yeah, and it'll be a very loose and informal conversation. And most of the time it'll be like, we're just having fun, we're goofing around, we're just joking about stuff and just talking about it for most of the episodes. And it's pretty cool because like a lot of these urban legends have been around for a long time. But actually, some of them are quite recent, especially when we go over our creepypasta episode. And I'm sure it'll all be a fun blast. It'll just be so much fun, and we're definitely going to like enjoy ourselves throughout the whole ride. And that's about it. And we both hope to see y'all in the listening in the future. Hello, and welcome to Ghost Stories and Ghouls. Today we have me and my co-host, Greg and Dawson.
What's up, guys? I'm Dawson.
I'm Greg. So today, are you excited what we're talking about, Dawson?
Yeah, we're going to be covering the story of the Yule Lads and then dissecting it a bit and, you know, just having some fun all around.
All right. We're going to go ahead and roll the intro. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and tell the story. And after we do that, we're going to go ahead and talk about it, you know, have fun with it. Let me tell the story of the lads, a few charms who once upon a time used to visit our farms. They came from the mountains, as many of you know, in a long single file line to the farmsteads below. Gria was their mother. She gave them ogre milk, and their father, Lepuudi, a loathsome milk. They were called the Yule Lads. At Yuletide, they were due and always came one by one, never two by two. 13 altogether. These gents in their prime didn't want to hurt people all at one time. Creeping up all stealth, they unlocked the door, the kitchen, and the pantry. They came looking for it. They hid where they could while a cunning look or sneer, ready with their pranks when people weren't near. And even when they were seen, they weren't loath to roam and play their tricks, disturbing the peace of the home. Stiff Legs was the first. Like a stick of wood, he came to prey upon the farmer's sheep. And following his game, he wished to suck on the ewes. But it was no accident. He couldn't because his knees were stiff. Not too convenient. Gully Guck came second. Gray his head and beam. He snuck into the cow barn from his craggy ravine. Hiding in their stalls, he would steal the milk while the milkmate gave the herd a meaningful smile. Stubby was the third called, a stunted little man who watched for every chance he got to whisk off a pan. and scurrying away with it, he scraped off the bits that stuck to the bottom and brooms, his favorites. The fourth one was spoon liquor. Like Spindle, he was thin. He felt himself in clover when the cook wasn't in, then stepping up, he grappled the stirring spoon with glee, holding it with both hands, for it was slippery. Pot Scrapper, the fifth, was a funny sort of chap. When kids were given scrappings, he'd come to the door and tap, and the children would rush to see if there really was a guest. Then he hurried to the pot and had a scraping fest. Bowl Liquor, the sixth one, was shockingly ill-bred. From underneath the bed sets, he hung his ugly head. And when the bowls were left to be licked by a dog or cat, he snatched them for himself. He was sure good at that. The seventh was Door Slammer. A devil of abuse, when people in the twilight would take a little snooze, he felt happy as a lark, with a havoc he would wreak, slamming doors and hearing the hinges on them squeak. Scare Gobbler, the eighth, was an awfully stupid bloke. He lambasted the skillet up till the lid on it broke. Then he would keep gobbling. His greed was well known. He would gobble until he was about to burst. He would bleat, howl, and groan. The ninth was Sausage Swiper, a shifty pilferer. He climbed up to the rafters and raided the food from there. Sitting on the crossbeam in soot and smoke, he fed himself on sausage fit for gentlefolk. The tenth was Window Peeper. Wicked, creepy twit, who stepped up to the window and stole a peek, and whatever was inside, to which his eye was drawn, he most likely attempted to take later on. 11th was Door Sniffer, adultage lad and gross. He never got a cold, yet had a huge, sensitive nose. He caught the scent of leaf bread while leeks still away, and ran toward it, weightless, as went over dale and hill. Meat Hook, the 12th, his talent would display as soon as he arrived on St. Sarlacc's Day. He shagged himself a morsel of meat of any sort, although his hook at times was tiny bit short. The 13th was Candle Beggar. 'Twas cold, I believe, if he was not the last of the lot on Christmas Eve. He trailed after the little ones who, like happy sprites, ran about the farm with their fine tallow lights. On Christmas night itself, so a wise man writes, the lads were all restrained and just stared at the lights. Then one by one, they trotted off into the frost and snow. On Twelfth Night, the last of the lads used to go. Their footprints in the highlands are effaced now for long, the memories all turned to image and song. All right, so what'd you think of that story there?
Honestly, the Icelandic people got some funny names for all those guys, like Spoon Liquor, Bowl Liquor, Sausage Swiper.
Yeah, like...
It's pretty cool.
The only normal one is
normal.
Like...
Greg.
Oh, is that wrong? the only one that I don't think is weird is Meat Hook. I mean, that kind of makes sense.
I mean, they're all very self-explanatory, obviously.
I like Stubby. He seems like a homie.
Yeah, he's very chill.
Little boy. He's like our little Colin.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the name Gully Gack, you know, gives the Gully Gack 9,000. You like that one? Looking at me concerned over there.
We just cannot see
that. Stiff Legs. Yeah, what did you think of Stiff Legs? Because it's kind of weird. I mean, it's not weird. It's just like, it's humorous, but like what?
I mean, it's just strange. Like, I don't know. I mean, he's, you know, obviously the first Yule lad to come in the days, coming before Christmas, but. Just, I don't know why he just cannot bend his knees. It's just kind of a strange characteristic for an urban legend.
Yeah, actually, when I was looking it up, since there's a lot of different, like, stories and, like, other variations of it, a couple variations of it is just he has two pig legs.
Interesting.
And he just has no legs. And he just, like, waddles.
Yeah, so his legs are all sorts of messed up. Just no matter what story you go to.
A window peeper is such, like, an odd... Like, that sounds real tough,
right?
I'm being honest.
I did a little bit of research, and from what I found, Bowl Liquor was supposedly the smartest Yule lad, because he would wait under tables in the houses of families in Iceland, and would wait till they got all their leftovers from dinner and put it in bowls for their dogs, and as soon as they put it down before their dogs could get there, he would jump out and eat everything from the bowl. He was very cunning. The others kind of just, you know... vibe, then would just, especially like Door Slammer, would just run through houses and slam all the doors.
Yeah, Skyr Gobbler, which is Skyr is a type of Icelandic yogurt. In the story, it's just like he's the dumbest, which is like hilarious that they decided that they were just going to be like, this guy's an idiot. Yeah, Icelandic is, it's when looking at it, not knowing what anything
just like
means,
Russian
is just
cursive.
Scary.
Have you ever seen that? It's literally just like loops. It's like a cursive U just over and over again.
They were just like, let's just draw on the paper and hope that the people can read it. But yeah, I like a lot of these because a lot of Icelandic Christmas lore involves a lot of like. A lot of their purpose, because like what I think, because what do you think the purpose of was the?
Story? You know, the Yule Lad's mother, Grilla, was a deterrent for the naughty boys and girls because she would, So basically, Grilla was, an Icelandic beggar who would walk around villages and ask parents for their disobedient children, and then obviously all of them would say no, but if she found them to be truly disobedient, she would take them and go boil them and eat them. And so, you know, that's kind of like the lump of coal thing here in America, but just way more extreme. Like, if you're naughty, then you get eaten.
Because the purpose of this stuff was kind of just like most Christmas myths and folklore, is that it's about, like, teaching children to be obedient.
For sure.
Which is, it's pretty cool how a lot of cultures all have very... similar style. I mean,
the
characters.
I mean, that's for sure.
And you got Krampus.
But
they all come back
to, you know, one common theme, which is obedience, and you won't get anything unless you are obedient.
Because originally the Yule Lads were like violent.
They would do the same thing as their mother Grilla and go take and eat kids as well.
I didn't find much on the father.
The same thing. When I was researching, apparently it's Grilla's third husband, but there's no tales of the prior two, and the only thing about the father is that he loved the stew that she would make out of the boys and girls who were naughty.
Well,
yeah, he just would vibe in the ice caves in Iceland and then just eat child stew.
Just eating children.
That's how it is sometimes. He's got the life going on.
What's with them and eating children? That's such like a common, because it's even in just regular fairy tales, like Grimm fairy tales, like the witch in the gingerbread house, it's just like, hey, yo, I'm a snack on these kids.
That's kind of weird. I've never really gone in depth about why eating children, why not?
I mean, it scares them. But, I mean, like, all urban legends have some reason to exist. I mean, it's just this is an obedience one. Most Christmas ones are like that. So when we do our full episode, we'll definitely have some interesting... things to say about it, but what do you think of the like the descriptions, like the physical appearances
Yule
Lads?
It's kind of frightening. They're like little troll children, but I mean obviously they're grown men with beards, but they're just like little tiny trolls.
They're like supposed to be like sort of trolls because their mother is an ogre, their parents are ogres, and then they're like just like little ogres.
small ogre.
But it's it's just like the names, because I feel like that's another thing with when you're translating a language is that it doesn't exactly translate every time. So I feel like some of these names would sound
spoon liquor, bowl liquor.
Yeah, I feel like it wouldn't sound so weird if you actually knew the language. Because that's another thing with translation, where sometimes some languages, I don't know about if this is about Icelandic language. Or Icelandic.
Yeah, we'll just go with Icelandic.
Like, because some of these languages are like context-based. So, like, I feel like translation is like actually kind of difficult for a lot of languages, whereas a lot of context-based. Because some words have a bunch of meanings, and you just kind of have to figure it out. Which is also what's really cool about the people that know these languages, because it's like they can instantly like tell the. Because with English, we have a lot of very specific words.
I mean, we are obviously, you know, our language is a cultivation of multiple languages, and it's also a very, very recently developed language, like American English specifically. English in general, I mean, it's been around for a hot minute, but like a lot of these languages, you know, Icelandic and German and Spanish and stuff have been around for considerably longer than English has.
Yeah. and especially like Icelandic, because Icelandic was I think originally a Norse language, because you know the Vikings were there. But it's kind of cool how similar it looks to.
I mean, they all look crazy, Swedish, you know, like
Finnish. They all look crazy us.
That was kind of the wrong word, but they all look. What I meant to say was crazy similar. Just, you know, because they all originated from the same source. It's kind of like a Spanish to Portuguese thing. I mean, obviously, once you know the languages, you'll be like, you know, they're completely different. But, like, looking at them with someone who really hasn't studied them before, it's like, I mean, I couldn't differentiate which one's which.
Yeah. It's just so cool listening to it.
Do you know, like, if the Yule Lads carry over into Denmark and all the other Scandinavian countries?
I don't know. I think I saw something about Denmark. Denmark, actually, no, that's the Netherlands. We have a thing from the Netherlands in our actual episode that I'm, that's so tough. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, wait, no, I do know what you're talking about. Okay, never mind.
Well, yeah.
Yeah,
you know exactly.
We'll get into that one in episode one, guys. This is just kind of, you know, tip of the iceberg, starting to dive deep, you know, just getting everybody little interested.
Of the episode.
Be the goal.
But it's kind of interesting, to me how, like, Iceland, from what I can see, like, how many urban legends just exist.
Dude, so many. I mean,
so many, and they can show up at any time. Like, recent years, like, stuff with, like, creepypasta, stuff
and,
like that. It's
I
just
mean,
really
you know,
cool
you know,
how that happens.
Cooler, you know, going a little more in-depth than that is, like, there are so many urban legends just between, you know, families even that have never really been talked about in the public eye that, like, you know, a certain set of people living in, you know, West Virginia could, like, you know, put their lives on that, you know, say a goat, like a single goat on their property is haunted. And, you know, there's just so much crazy stuff like that.
I feel like family tradition and urban legend, like certain family traditions and urban legends kind of, like, go hand in hand. Like, for instance, like, I don't know. I don't know how to, like, describe this, but I think there's, like, just a lot of just cool stuff we can explore in future episodes. But I mean, I feel like this is going to be.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I'm very, very excited to dive deep into urban legends. I'm really excited to get to. We're going to be covering Mothman in the future. Very excited about that.
Yeah, Mothman. We got Wendigo, and especially when we talk about feminine. Yeah. Monsters and stuff like that. There's a lot of things that we can talk about at the time period,
I know,
and the stances on women. Because, for instance, with Medusa, we can talk about all sorts of things, especially how she first was depicted and how in Middle Europe, medieval era, how that perception of her kind of changed. From
and in the real episodes, we're going to dive very in depth into the culture, the history, everything that was going on at the time, and in hopes to try to uncover how these urban legends could have come to existed, really.
I wouldn't say there's, like, not a lot on the Yule Lads, but it's just the Yule Lads are very simple and easy concept to understand. So I think definitely when we do actual episodes.
And with the Yule Lads, I mean, it's a Christmassy episode. So we're, you know, considering the time we are on the holidays, we're going to be diving in depth and kind of covering a little bit of what we talked about today with the worldwide, like, behavioral deterrent of some of these urban legends in that episode. You know, just a little more in depth.
Yeah, so I'm definitely excited for future episodes. So we're going to go ahead and roll the outro, and
see
we'll see you next time.